What's absolutely crucial is getting to know them. I think the thing about my job is that one of the things I love is and you don't get a lot of contact time with the artist. I don't want to give you the impression that I'm there all the time, but it's spending time with them, finding out what they care about, honouring that. So you don't go, for example, into meeting a new director and you haven't read the script, because they'll talk to you like you have. And you know what? They're living and breathing this stuff.
Right.
And you go in there and you say, yeah, you can't set the house on fire. And they're like, are you kidding me? It's in, you know, it's in scene four, whatever four, and you've got to know that.
That was Anna Glover. And this is episode 11 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo, your host. It's great to have you, however and wherever you are listening, whether that's at work, on your commute, on your run or your workout, doing the chores, cooking, whatever. Welcome. It's great that you are with us. This is a show where I speak to all kinds of fascinating people, and I use the lenses of risk, resilience, randomness, and uncertainty to explore all kinds of topics. My guests share their insights, their journeys, and this creates, I think, some wonderful episodes. And around here, we go long, as in long form. The long form conversation is a lost art, but thanks to podcasting, it's making quite the resurgence. And it's no exception around here. We feature authentic conversations. And this is real talk about many topics and the conversations. They are unedited. They are uninterrupted. At least they're not intentionally interrupted. And the show will always be free of charge. The only thing that I ask is that if you enjoy the episodes and the show, you share, you subscribe, and or you leave a rating or a review, particularly on iTunes, but wherever you get the show, it takes only a few clicks and a few seconds. On to the show today and my guest. Before that, I'd like to start with a question, and that is, do you go to the theater? Have you been to a play lately, either live or as a broadcast? They tend to do broadcasts around the world from some of the world's most famous theaters. Well, if you have, you will know that they do some amazing things on the shows. They've got people flying. They have pigeons flying, birds flying. They set things on fire. And sometimes it's you almost don't even feel like you're watching a play. It's so amazing. Do you ever wonder how they do those things within the confines of a theater, how they balance the risk of attempting whatever they're trying to do while, I guess, maintaining the artistic integrity of the production? Well, I'd like to introduce to you my guest, Ms. Anna Glover. Anna leads the safety, risk, and fire management team here in London at the world-renowned National Theatre. Now, does that mean that she does health and safety? Well, as you'll soon find out, the answer to that is a resounding no. A good way of looking at Anna's job is that she helps these internationally acclaimed productions achieve their artistic visions, full stop. She's a core part of the teams that she works with. And I think that the work that she does really embodies what great risk management is all about. It's about taking risks with intelligence and confidence and achieving great things as a result. And along the way, she has worked on some incredible shows, War Horse, for example, The Light Princess. And she's worked with some amazing people. For example, Phyllida Lloyd, who directed Mamma Mia and The Iron Lady, Catherine Mallion, who's the executive director of the Royal Shakespeare Company here in London, Paula Constable, who won the British Award for Best Lighting Design multiple times, and she's worked with many, many others. We obviously talk about this fascinating line of work, but there's much more to Anna than this, and we explore her path, how she found herself doing this type of work. Going from studying in North Wales to working in an outdoor pursuit shop to running a climbing center in a military defense base. This is a wonderful part of the conversation that is all about finding your calling, or more precisely, how to let it find you. And for someone working professionally in risk, or actually in any profession, I'd say, it's about how to leverage one experience and kind of let that flow into the next one. And this is an absolutely amazing conversation. I loved it. We talk about certainly her fascinating work in the National Theater and performing arts. That includes a great story about working with Juliette Binoche, her path working in North Wales. And that includes an interesting run-in with Saranal Fiennes, how she got into this line of work, including her work in other world-renowned performing arts venues and centers. We talk about martial arts. Anna is an amazing Hapkidoist. She's a second Dan in this art that I also study. And we go deep about finding your path and much, much more. This is an awesome conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm certain that you will as well. Ladies and gentlemen, enter stage right, my friend, Ms. Anna Glover. Enjoy. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So any opportunity to speak to interesting people is one that'll gladly take. So thank you for being here. First question is, what do you do? Or when you get asked that question, what do you do?
There's a
cocktail party question that we often get.
Yeah, and it's a really hard one to answer, especially at parties.
That's great, because these are the most interesting people, ones who struggle to answer that question. But please.
So I head up the safety, risk, and fire management team at the National Theatre, and it's one of those job titles where people listen to it and they go, "Does that mean you do health and safety?" Mm. And I really don't. One of the reasons I don't is because when people ask you what you do at parties, if you say health and safety, they go, "Uh huh," and then they walk away. It used to be that you'd say, "Oh, I work at the National Theatre," and they go, "Really? What do you do?" And then you'd say, "I do health and safety," and they, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm going to talk to someone else. Mm. But what that actually means in practice is a lot of things. So I look at the productions, and I look at the different effects that go into the productions, and I'm part of a team of people that will help look at those and say, okay, you want to set a house on fire? Mm. These are the things we need to think about. Mm. And then outside of the theatre, I'll look at the business risk as well. And so we're beginning to look at risk, not just in terms of safety risk, but financial infrastructure, reputation, all of the things that I'm sure job today you know and you do instinctively. But actually, the theatre industry is coming to terms with this. So the financial sector of the theatre industry is really good at this stuff. But outside of that, outside of fraud or in those, we weren't really considering business recovery. How do you do business recovery in a theatre? If your theatre's burnt down, do you really want to do it somewhere else? Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the BAC found that out recently, that you do want to take a show on tour and you can have a life outside of that. So, but there is no typical day for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I have things that I'll go in the office and I want to do, and then the phone will ring, and I've had, we want to burn some coffee on the roof. How many pigeons do I need for a show? If I want to put a pigeon in a show, how many do I need and what do I think about? And the best one I had was, we want to set someone on fire.
What show was that for?
I've done it twice, actually.
Oh, okay.
So the first time was an adaptation of the book Behind the Beautiful Forevers. Mm-hmm. And it's set in the slums of India. Amazing book. And the show itself had multiple effects that we were working on. There's a massive, wonderful moment at the end that I don't want to spoil too much, because you definitely have to read the book. But there is a big jump that takes place. And we had to replicate that on stage. Mm. And what I love about theatre that's different from film is we don't have to do it. You know, you see in Mission Impossible Tom Cruise clinging to the plane and the plane will take off, but in theatre, if you get the feeling right, then you don't actually have to do the stunt, but there are a few that you want to do on stage, and so the jump was one of them. But there's a moment in the play where someone goes inside a house and sets themselves on fire, and they wanted to do it, and then they come out. That's the easy part. Okay, you shut the doors, you put some haze up, then they come out and their arm and their body's burning. Mm. And we knew that they've done it in films 1,000 times, but in films it's such a easy, you know, thing that you can set up. You've got someone who's there to stand by.
Can be all controlled.
Exactly. But in theatre, you know, there is a moment when a play starts, when the magic starts, and you take audience on a narrative. And if you pile in lots of safety and lots of people who are not used to that, it wrecks the moment. That fourth wall is completely broken.
Interesting.
So when they said, we want the doors to open and we want her to come out on fire, and you know, you can't have burly firemen running on stage and putting this person out, we thought, well, here's a challenge. How do we go about doing that? So you look at the standard ways that they do it in Hollywood. But the other crucial part is you have to be able to replicate this 200, 300 times.
Right.
So one of the coolest things we found was a gel that you put on the arm that you can set fire to.
Hmm.
And the gel's cold, but it burns. So essentially you've got a barrier between the skin and the flame effect.
So did you have to get involved in finding out how finding this gel and these things?
I mean, look, the production teams do a lot of that work, but we will, and there's myself and a couple of other people, we help. And that's good fun. You know, Google is your friend. And there's a fantastic network of people that you send the email out and you say, has anyone else done this? And you know,
I can't imagine that's a huge network.
It's getting bigger, but you're right, actually. We have a joke that there's a few of us doing this job, and when the music stops, we all change jobs, because you'll often see someone moves to this theatre company and someone moves to that one. But yeah, it's a kind of a knowledge that you get the longer you work in the industry. So you might ask that question. You ask film people what they've done with. But the thing about the gel was that, okay, you can apply it once, but you can't apply it when you get up to 50 or 60 times. It starts to produce an adverse effect on the skin.
Okay.
So, which we knew from just talking to people, and I mean, we applied it four or five times, and people started to say, okay, I'm itching. So, okay, we now can't do that for matinees and evening shows. So what we came up with was a silicone mold that was like a long lady's glove that went into the hand and then all the way up the arm, which had a gas pipe running through it, and then the gas cylinder hidden under the actor's arm. And she would disappear, the glove would be put on, then the fire effect would happen, and then she would come out onto the stage. The sad thing was that this often happens in theatre, you work really hard for a particular effect. During the technical period, we became aware that the amount of time that the actor needed to take to practice this particular moment wasn't available. We weren't going to be able to get it ready for press night. And then you just... that it gets cut. So what happened then was a massive special effect behind the scenes, and then the actor put on prosthetics to look like there was a burn, and quickly they were put down and put out. So we didn't manage to achieve that particular one. But then it came up again, and this was one of the most incredible things I've ever done. We were approached by a performance artist called Castles. They're a gender neutral, so it's one person, but they prefer to be referred to as Castles. And that presents its own challenges, because you want to honour the artist with whatever they want, however they want to work. But communication is such a key part of the role that even putting that small, you know, don't refer to me in the female pronoun, it's got to be Castles, you just had to check yourself every time you spoke. But anyway, Castles wanted to do a full body burn in front of an audience of people. So and inside a theatre, inside our smallest theatre as well. So that kind of thing presents huge challenges. What's it going to do to the rest of the environment? What's the temperature going to be like? What happens if, as sometimes happens during a burn, that the person panics and they run forward? We've then got a running person on fire into the audience. The insurance company went crazy. You can't do this. You know, how do we even start to quantify this risk? And so we set up rehearsal periods, but it was literally a person standing completely naked on stage, being dressed in the protective equipment, and then being set on fire. And it was just a stunning moment. And we achieved the full burn with three stuntmen on stage ready to put the person out. And they, once the burns, what they do is they induce a hypothermia. They dress the artist in clothes that've been dipped in tea tree oil. Soaking wet, freezing cold. Then they put on the hero suit that the Formula One racers then you put on the clothes, the costume, then accelerant is applied because you can't just, it's really hard to set fire to someone. Then you put on the accelerant, then you set fire to them. You have to set fire to the lower parts of the body because it spreads so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Then the artist has to lean forward to get the flames away from the mouth. They have to hold their breath the whole time because if they breathe in, it immediately burns the esophagus.
So did castles do this type of thing before?
This was the second time it'd been done, and the first time ever in front of a live audience.
Right.
So Castles is a performance artist and does extreme. They do extreme bodybuilding, for example. They've done work with ice.
Mm-hmm.
They've done throwing themselves off buildings. Mm-hmm. But this was the first kind of one like this.
So, you know, they could have reacted in a very adverse way in the moment.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly. And one of the things I learned was just the importance of the relationship that the artist had to the people they were working with. I mean, you kind of understand that instinctively anyway, but when you see it in action, you know, I had to look in the artist's eyes and know that they were capable of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then the artist had to build up the trust with the team, because one of the, right at the last minute, we found out that actually Castles had not worked with the team that they brought in before.
Yes.
And we'd all assumed that, and you kind of go, wow, that's a whole other level of risk. But once they've held their breath for the 15, 20 seconds, then they have to lie on the floor and they're put out using CO2 extinguishers. Have to make sure they're out and then quickly get them off, get them into a shower to get them warm and just see if there's been any burn effects.
Right.
And yeah, it was really nerve-wracking.
You said something that was really interesting just now, which was you had to look into the artist's eyes and see if they were ready for it.
Yeah.
And how is that a question? Is that something that you can sort of tell instinctively? How do you tell? What are you looking for when proposing something?
I read something recently that said the more you study and take on information, the better your gut feeling gets. You know, where does a hunch come from?
Interesting.
And the thing that I love about the job I do is that element of kind of putting the finger up into the wind and seeing which way it's blowing. I mean, okay, there's absolutely a grounding in safety that you need. You need the technical knowledge. You need the regulations. You know that. But then there comes the point of saying, okay, on paper we can do this, but can we actually do this? Am I looking at someone that can do that?
Yeah.
And it's practice. It's working with artists over time. But what's absolutely crucial is getting to know them. I think the thing about my job is that one of the things I love is and you don't get a lot of contact time with the artist. I don't want to give you the impression that I'm there all the time, but it's spending time with them, finding out what they care about, honouring that. So you don't go, for example, into meeting a new director and you haven't read the script, because they'll talk to you like you have. And you know what? They're living and breathing this stuff.
Right.
And you go in there and you say, yeah, you can't set the house on fire. Mm-hmm. And they're like, are you kidding me? It's in, you know, it's in scene four, whatever four, and you've got to know that.
Yeah.
So you find out what makes them tick, and you also can see if they're not happy with it. It's everything in the body that. So I mentioned a jump earlier. There was the actor and the understudy that had to do the jump, and the actor he came across as we put them both through circus school training to get them to do this particular stunt, and one of them relished it. You could tell his body was relaxed. He was trying to test the limits of what he could do. But he just seemed to be able to be himself or be the character he needed to be. The understudy just was clinging onto things, was asking lots of questions. So you watch that behavior and you say, you know what? He can't jump as high, which is fine. But in this scenario, he's not going to want to say, I can't do it. There's a lot of face. And also, because the acting industry can be so cruel, people don't want to say I was the troublemaker. So that's when I step in and say, I think I don't want him to do that.
Right.
So that he can then say, oh, you know, give me a chance. But there are times when you you go in and say, I don't think that's a good idea, or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that happens in the workplace a lot because people don't want to admit that they don't know something, they can't do something.
Yeah.
And the point about instinct and gut feel is a really pertinent one, because I think that's where true expertise comes out, and it's hard to there are things that are hard to teach, but it's just sort of that repetition. I don't know if you've read the Malcolm Gladwell's article on choking, failing versus choking, and the problem with when we choke is we do something repetitively and we get instinctively very good at it. But when the pressure is on, we slow it right down, and our instead of our muscle memory or whatever, the I guess the gut feel that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
we think too much about it,
mm-hmm.
and that's when you see, you know, a tennis player not be able to serve a ball that they
yeah.
he could do thousands of times in their sleep, and that sort of repetition,
yeah.
Or that in your case the amount of experience I'm sure you have looking at, you know, all the different mm-hmm. artists that you've worked with, you can kind of tell, but. It's hard to put your finger on it, I imagine.
Yeah, and you can also contribute in a negative way to mm. that. So the other thing I'm really aware of is that you can add so many layers of safety, so many things that they have
right.
to think about that
right.
you actually prevent the artist from being able to do the
right.
thing they need to do.
Right.
So there's a balancing act between, you know, absolutely you want to keep someone safe. There is no show that's worth a person's life. You know, that's not their risk to take.
Mm-hmm.
But you can go too far the other way,
mm-hmm.
and actually these are people that have what we call rehearsed competency. So we give them
okay.
6 weeks of just doing the same thing over and over again,
mm-hmm.
and the more you kind of say remember this, remember that, you know, they've got to get out there, they're not being themselves, they're being a character, they're fitting in with the play, they're trying to
yes.
react to something else, you then say remember to clip this in, remember to do that. And it wrecks it. And I've actually seen the effects of safety. I was working on a show called The Emperor Jones, a fantastic, phenomenal play. And there was a moment where the emperor had to climb an incredibly steep ladder, hide out of sight at height, and then he kind of falls down, and he's completely... I think he's dead at this point in the show, and he falls down. Mm. But the bit where he falls, he was actually on a rope and we were lowering him down. So at some point, we had to get him into a harness, get him clipped in, and then lower him. And we were trying to figure out how we get him into his harness underneath his costume. Now, the show was an hour and a half long with no interval, incredibly physical, and the guy was throwing himself around on the stage. And for the first few weeks of rehearsal, we had him in the harness as well, and all he could feel weren't the clothes of the character, was the harness next to his skin. So you have to, well, not next to his skin, but you had to hide it, but enough for him to feel it. Actually, that's not working because he can't get into where he needs to be.
Sure.
It's not natural, and you can constantly feel this thing. So, okay, can we get him to climb the ladder, which, you know, is
yes.
is not totally safe, but look, we all do it, so let's find a way of doing that. Get him up at height, then get him into the harness so that actually when he's out of sight, he can drop his character, and then he's coming down dead anyway.
Mm.
Yeah, it took a little bit of working and kind of finagling, but we did that. And suddenly he's happier and he can just get on with what he's doing.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So, yeah, you have to figure that out. But then some actors, they want that level of safety and they want to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
So the reverse of that was actually one of my career highlights, which was working with Juliette Binoche.
Interesting.
So yeah, I'm getting straight into the
details. Yeah,
let's
get into it. Yeah.
So, you know, she, phenomenal actor, worked on The English Patient. I couldn't wait to meet her.
Hmm.
She was doing a piece called In I when she was dancing with Akram Khan, who's also one of my
right.
favourite dancers. I mean, this for me was like Christmas.
Hmm.
And there was a moment in the show, it was about a relationship, and the artist Amish Kapoor had designed the set. I mean, it really was the Holy Trinity. And this beautiful wall, and the idea was that during... That Akram Khan was teaching Juliet how to dance, she was teaching him how to act, and they were putting
okay.
both elements into the show. So both of them were doing the pieces they weren't particularly happy with. During the dance piece, Akram Khan wanted to throw Juliet Binoche up against the wall. She would then hang there for, I don't know, 10 minutes, and then come down and dance again. So that's problematic for lots of ways, because you're in suspension, you're not moving, and then you've got to come down and dance.
Wow.
And also, how do you achieve the effect of throwing someone up against a wall and sticking them there? So we looked at Velcro, which is just doesn't work. And then we came up with an incredibly strong electromagnetic piece behind the wall.
Right.
And then she was wearing a kind of a harness with something on that.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I had to do was I had to actually take Juliette Binoche through her harness training
okay.
and get her used to sitting in the harness. And it was challenging because Akram was completely convinced that she could hang there in this particular way for so long and then dance, and
mm-hmm.
I was completely convinced she couldn't.
Hmm.
But how do you tell this guy that that's not going to work?
Mm.
So what we agreed to do was set up some tests, and then bringing Juliette Binoche into an area where we could get her into a harness, suspend her up, have her feel it, and then she could also give feedback as well. So the great day arrives, and I have not met her, and she turns up with an enormous tray of birthday cake, which was immediately a plus. There was myself and two other guys from the technical team. She said, "It's my birthday," and I thought I'd share cake with you all. She was completely charming, really, really wonderful person. So I'm fitting the harness on, but I'm being super aware that it's Juliet.
Yes.
So I'm you know, trying to be careful, not wanting to talk too much. And I, at one point, I look up at her face just before we're about to suspend her, and I see fear. And I realised, do you know what? She doesn't need me to act like it's Juliette Binoche. She needs me to just do my job. She needs me to get the harness fitted correctly. We were suspending her over a chasm, so she was going to feel what it was like at height.
So how far up
was this? We were putting her, it must have been about 3 meters off the ground.
Okay.
So it was kind of a lift shaft area that had been designed for this kind of work. And you put the person in the harness, suspended them, and then moved them out over. So there was an element of control, but they felt that. And that was a big moment for me, because I thought, you know, she knows she's famous. She doesn't need me to remind her. But what she does need right now is to feel safe. And that's what I need to do. And so, you know, she also wanted to feel the harness. And so, you know, where some people find that restrictive, she needed that. So I learned a lot that day. And we ended up, she sat in the harness. She felt, yes, it would restrict her dancing. We developed something else, which was a kind of a hidden chair that was built into a coat. So she was kind of sitting on something, but it wasn't quite that. So it was win-win all the way. But a great moment. But really, yeah, it really made me realize, you know what, these people are people. And which sounds so stupid, because of course they are, but when you meet someone that has been your idol, you just think, I really want you to like me.
Good. There's no getting autographs at that point or whatever. So that's really interesting. I want to get back to some of that, but I also did want to talk a little bit about your background and to find out, you know, how you got into this wonderful, fascinating field in the first place.
There was no plan, I can tell you that.
I think that's the way it works for a lot of us. That there is no plan. But I'd be interested to find out, you know, how a little bit about your background, whether or not what your ambitions were, maybe growing up or that kind of thing, and then how you found your way into doing this really interesting work.
Sure. Well, both my parents were really interested in science. My father's a conservationist. Mm-hmm. So growing up, I was completely convinced I was going to be either a marine biologist or a zoologist. I read everything that I could get my hands on. You know, I kept pets. Every time we went anywhere, I was collecting specimens, nature trails, fossils, absolutely obsessed. And then I hit sort of 16 and decided, actually, I think I'm really interested in words. I became a little bit rebellious. I think growing up with a father who takes you bird watching every possible avenue, you know, you've seen ospreys and I had a kestrel as a pet once and a magpie as a pet. So I kind of did all the whole Gerald Durrell thing and just rebelled against it, found words, wanted to write more than anything. I had rubbish short stories. I got a really rubbish poem published, but so I decided to go to university and study English literature.
Right.
And for lots of personal reasons, didn't get the choices I wanted and ended up studying in North Wales, which was phenomenally, it was wonderful university, and I got it just sheer by chance. I was... I kind of, when you put down all your choices at the time, I don't know if the system is still the same, you know, you put your top choices down, but you have to fill all five, I think it was. So I put Bangor down and said, well, it'd be nice to visit, if nothing else, and that's where I ended up going.
Okay.
And I had, you know, I had a great time at the university. It was so beautiful studying in Snowdonia. And the university has a really fantastic history, which I think just adds to it. The original community of miners decided they wanted their children to not be miners. So they put together, if I remember my history rightly, parts of the salaries went to a fund to build the university. And in this way that I just love the way that people do this, they actually got they paid for a professor to come in and start teaching the kids at university level before the university was built. So they kind of built the need for it before the building. And to this day, the old building is still stunningly situated on top of the university hill.
Interesting.
So I actually feel that there was a great tradition in Bangor that is different from the traditions that we know about Oxford and Cambridge, but it was really good. It was founded on something really great. So I did enjoy it, but I struggled with the learning the criticism. I felt that it was, you know, it was, I was much more interested
in... Like literary criticism,
yeah,
you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like taking apart a piece of text or something like
because
that.
Because I felt that we were just looking at one interpretation of it. I mean, okay, these were fine minds I was reading of people that really understood this stuff. But I sometimes felt like, actually, what if we were just meant to feel this?
Yes.
I became really interested in philosophy and psychology. But I stuck it out with English. But when I left university, I thought, I don't ever want to open another book again. It's not true now. I read a lot, but I was just done with it.
I had a similar experience in graduate school where you sort of, different field altogether, but you similar idea around unpicking, you know, applying theories to things that are really, you know, things that I used to think were very interesting, international relations, international politics and intrigue and all of this stuff, taking, you know, sort of this lens, a social constructivist lens to this and that, and it just it just killed my interest in the subject matter. And unfortunately, I think higher education sometimes does that. But it sounded like it was good experience nonetheless. To be there and to get exposed to some interesting works that you studied.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the Welsh language as well is beautiful.
Right.
I mean,
did you study Welsh then, or did
I can't speak it. I'm ashamed to say. I've got a couple of words that I could ask you for a tisio paned, a cup of tea, or something, or say croeso for welcome. But just that they also looked at English translations of Welsh poets, like R.S. Thomas. There's a fantastic poem. I wish I could quote it verbatim, but it's called The Bright Field, and I recommend you have a look at it because it's just beautiful. But things like that made it very interesting too. And there were some great, topics that they created for us to look at. Studying children's literature was fascinating. You know, it sounded like an easy topic, but, just looking at something. And I suppose actually that's helped when you look at theatre, because we do children's theatre sometime, and it's a serious business, children's theatre. The fun is serious. Yeah. So, maybe that was useful, but I was done with it when I was finished.
Right.
So,
Did you go with any intention that you wanted to be a certain thing or get a certain type of line of work afterwards or anything like that?
No, I have to say, I was completely lost, and I just knew that getting a degree was a good thing. And I think if I could go back and do something different, then I would probably say, actually, maybe Anna at that time wasn't ready for a degree and should have done something else. But I also try to say to myself, you make the choices at the time what you think is the best, so you have to honour them when you're like, you know, it's good to go back and think, what would I do if I was doing it again? But I wish I could find a way to help what I think are the lost generation, the people that come out of a university education who've perhaps chosen a pure subject because they don't really know what to specialise in, and they come out and they're still lost. And I felt really strongly that I'd been spat out of the education system. Look, I'd done everything I was supposed to do at GCSE, A-level, university, great. Now what? And the world went, well, you should have figured that out by now. And I felt there was something wrong with me because I didn't have that desire. And people kept saying to me, oh, you'll find your passion. And I think it's like when people want to fall in love and they try too hard and you know it's never going to happen until they stop trying. So I was casting about for all sorts of things to do, and I managed to get, I worked in a pub for a while, I stayed around the area because it was beautiful and I was happy there, and then I started to get a bit of work in an outdoor pursuit shop, and I took up some climbing, and then someone said to me, during the summer, do you want to come whitewater rafting in Nottingham and kind of come down to the Nottingham Trent and have a go? I had a go at it. The raft capsized and I ended up under the raft and I swallowed most of the Trent and I was absolutely terrified and cross. And I thought, you know what? I have to learn how to do this.
Yeah, this isn't going to beat me.
Yeah, it isn't going to beat me. It's completely alien to the sorts of thing I might normally take up. I've been very cerebral for 3 years, but for that reason as well, it really appealed to me. And so I learnt how to raft on the course. You take a summer of kind of basically being like the learner driver. So you sit on a lot of rafts and then you start taking over for a few runs, and then you learn how to pull up a few tricks, and then you have to sit first aid courses and that. And I loved it. I really did. I learned to drive power boats. And yeah, it was great. Different groups that you take out. I mean, some rafting groups you take out were like stag do's, and they just wanted to get as wet as possible, and they were all hungover. But then you'd take out groups where maybe the kids were terrified of water, and you'd see them build up their stamina.
So is this where you think the ability to see fear in someone's eyes started?
You know, it might well have been. I haven't ever thought about that. I think it's definitely where the love of doing something risky comes from. I think if you really want to do safety, I think you have to be prepared to be unsafe.
That's right. I agree with that.
I can't imagine. I mean, I know your thing. Risk is life. I absolutely agree with that. And everybody that I've heard you interview, you know, Taryn's paddle down the Amazon. Like, he put the risk where it needed to be. So he was prepared. There were things he didn't know, but he didn't just rock up one day with his kayak, and it was like, you know, I'm going to make sure I've got the right food and all of that stuff. And so I think for me, starting to do outdoor pursuits was, this is fun, it's risky, but we're doing it over and over again, but we are qualified guides with the right equipment, you know, and on a man-made course. So it was funny though, on the man-made course meant that people often came to train down the course for bigger expeditions they were doing. And there was kind of rules on the road on the course, you know. So the rafts aren't as flexible as the canoes, the kayaks that are on the course. So usually, as much as we tried not to run them over, sometimes if we were coming their way, they kind of had to get out of our way because we weren't as flexible. And when you come into an eddy, you approach it at speed, and then you kick your back around, and it gets picked up by the eddy and it goes in. Well, I was headed for this particular area, and I was yelling to the kayak ahead of me, and I'm coming in, coming in, and he wasn't listening. So I'm sorry, and I barreled into him and knocked him over. It was Ranulf Fiennes. He was great. He was really great, but I was like, yeah, I really didn't want to hurt him. But you know,
did you talk to him afterwards?
It just in the actual eddy as he was going around, and he kind of came up spluttering, and the guy who was training with him was great, and just said, well, that's, you're gonna have to learn how to capsize. And I was just like, sorry, you know, and but don't want to do that too many times.
I'm sure you I'm sure you taught him a lesson.
Well, I'm sorry.
Maybe he remembers that. I don't know.
God, yeah, if he's listening, my name is something else, you know.
Oh, that's really interesting. I could kind of I love these types of conversations, because you can kind of see, you can join a few of the dots in your life, perhaps.
You're joining dots that I hadn't thought about. So
it's a lot. But I fully agree with this concept of you can't do safety unless you're prepared to take risk, right?
Yeah.
So people are in situations where safety is a concern because they're trying to do something and they're trying to achieve something. And if you just put the, you know, just clamp down on that, you're taking away something from them.
Yeah.
And you're taking away something that, you know, it might be very deep and very, very profound. And that's not what you're there to do.
Yeah.
You're there to help and facilitate them doing, doing what they mean to be doing. And sometimes they might not be aware of the chances of things going wrong or what the hazards are, which is another thing. But the last thing you want to do is to stop someone from doing what they love and pulling something off. So no, that's very very interesting. How long were you doing that for then?
I did it for 2 years, but it was mostly a summer job. So there's a point in Nottingham when they stop working because it's just far too cold.
Yeah.
I mean, it's deeply unpleasant, you know, it gets to November time. And also, you know, being freelancer, if it flooded, the work dried up. And so I was supplementing it with working in an outdoor pursuit shop when the local Ministry of Defence base, Joint Services Mountain Centre Indefatigable, which was situated in the town of Clanvaya, Porgwynge, Gogeren, Clangoboy, Clantasilia, Gogogoch, which I had to learn how to say because I was there.
So can you say that again?
But the locals call it Clanvaya PG.
Okay.
So they basically...
I have to put that in the show notes now. So
you're going to have to spell it. Yeah. Okay. It's a great little town, but the Ministry of Defence that was there, the base, wanted to sell equipment from the base. So they said to my shop that I worked at just part-time, would you open a small shop there? And my shop said to me, would you go and do some work for them? And then that went quite well. So they then built a huge climbing wall mm-hmm. on the base with a gym and a cafe. And they said to the shop I worked at, if you put a shop inside this, yes. will you also staff it? So my boss turned to me and said, have you got any interest at all in running a climbing wall for the MOD? And I had no experience at all. And I said, absolutely. So I left at the end, sort of the end winter of my second rafting summer and just said, I'm going to start running this climbing wall. Entreprise, this the company that built the resin wall that was part of it, set up some initial climbs. But in terms of that, I had a bucket load of different types of holds that they created, and a bucket load of bolts, and I could just create whatever climbs I wanted to. It was a purely MOD base. So the MOD would book in clients to come. So I had these insanely busy times when huge groups would turn up and use the wall, and then I was open from sort of 10 in the morning till 10 at night. Long periods of time where there was no one there. And the local people weren't allowed to use it, which we didn't agree with, but it wasn't my call. I was getting paid absolute peanuts, but the upside was I had loads of friends who were climbers, and I would just give them a call and say, centre's empty, guys, come along. And so we would have nights where we'd just be bouldering and playing around. It was amazing. It was really special. So the shift work we did was 4 days on, 4 days off. So they were intense 4 days, but then you've got these wonderful 4 days of freedom. that was really great. And I learned how to run a gym and run a climbing wall and run a cafe and have a lot of fun.
Very cool.
So that was really great. There were some moments though. So I was there when the Twin Towers were hit.
Right.
And you can forget you're working on a Ministry of Defence base until something like that happens. So I remember that we had an old television that people used to sometimes, what we run climbing films on there and stuff. The quartermaster ran in, he said, turn the television on. And before you knew it, we had a group of people sitting around the TV. And, you know, the second tower was hit and the guys' buzzers were going off. They were already being called into action. So it was, there were sobering moments. But there was good fun moments as well. Competitions that we ran and, the people I got to climb with. I was climbing with members of the mountain rescue team. Great pilots, who would just come and wind down after the training they'd gone through or rescuing people. So, it was really special.
Cool. It sounds like very special, very interesting. You eventually moved to London.
What
brought you there? And
After a while, you think to yourself, this is great, but what's my life? Where's my life going? So I decided I was going to become a physiotherapist, and I had an English degree. This is totally me to just completely change direction, but I thought, this is great. I'll get to work with active people and help them. So I went back to college to do an A-level in biology. I was doing that whilst I was doing the second year of climbing. I did an intense year course. And the day my results were due to come out, I was so sure I'd failed, I refused to go and pick them up. So I did something I never normally do. I bought a paper and I sat out in the garden and I read the paper because I'm going to do something completely different. And I opened up the paper and it said that a book that I really loved at the time, Jeanette Winston's Power Book, was going to be adapted for a play in London.
Interesting.
And at the time, my sister was in London and she was acting on the stage. And I thought, I'd love to see this. And I kind of put it away and didn't really think about it. And then my result came out. It was enough for me to start on the journey. So I was still thinking about being a physiotherapist. And I thought, well, I'll go and see my sister. And, she's like one of my best friends, so I can talk to her about all sorts of things. So I went to London. I thought, actually, I'm just going to book a ticket to see this show as well. I'll see my sister in her show and I'll see this show. So I booked a ticket and I got... I was really poor being a climbing guide, a climbing wall instructor. So the National at the time did this fantastic ticket for £10 or something right at the back. And so I went in to see the show and I sat down. It was 90 minutes straight through. And I remember drawing a breath at the beginning and I think I let it out at the end, but I don't remember breathing from the whole of the 90 minutes. I never thought it would happen to me, but it happened to me. When I wasn't looking for it, I found exactly what it is I was missing. The show, I don't think the script was particularly amazing. It wasn't the actors. It was just, it started with this film of this person swimming, and then this huge cube kind of dropped out of the sky and someone came down a ladder, and I just began to feel things that I hadn't had a reaction to in art before. You know, people talk about getting chills seeing a painting or something, and I have done that now, but up to that point that was new for me. And all those words I'd written, all those books, I'd kind of felt glimmers of it, but this was it kind of writ large. And the thing that got me was not the acting. I never wanted to be an actor. It was just, how did they do that? What's the scaffolding behind that? So you know, I came out onto the South Bank, and it's beautiful. You know, the booksellers were there, and the Thames was there, and I just thought, well, this is different. But I feel something for this. So I stayed an extra day in London. I bought another ticket. I saw the show again, and this time I sat in the front row. And I watched it all again, and I was, you know, looking up at the grid and looking around at things, and I thought, I just have to do this. So I kind of went back to Wales and gave him my notice and moved to London. It was just, you know, and the other thing that struck me about some of the people that you've spoken to and the people that I really admire is they find a thing that they can't not do.
Something grabs hold of them.
And there's lots of reasons why you shouldn't do it. Maybe it's financially suicide or whatever, but there's something in you that just says, I'm going to keep, I
That's
have
right.
to do this.
That's
you know,
right.
so,
yes.
so I guess that was the same for me. It was probably a really stupid idea.
You know, I don't know that there are any stupid ideas in this day and age now. You know, you look at people who are supposed to go down the sort of classic career path or what you described. You know, you did everything that you were supposed to do. There are people who, you know, they do that until they're, you know, they're sort of 50, and then they turn around and you know, look at their lives and say, what have I been doing? You know, so there's something to this. There's something to letting this sort of happen to you, letting life happen to you, not being sort of apathetic and just, trying things and doing things, but there's something to it. And it's hard to put your finger on it, but it's a similar sort of pattern that things grab you and they don't let go.
And you have to put yourself in the way of that, don't you? I think, you know, whether you're the sort of person that can, you know, move to Thailand and box, or whether whether it's just, you know, going to see that show or doing that thing.
Yes.
Put yourself in the way of it and it'll happen one day, you know. That's what I believe now, but if I could tell my 20-year-old self coming out of university something, I'd say just put yourself in the way of absolutely everything and something will happen to you. But you know what, I wasn't skilled in theatre at all. I had no you know, I knew my sister being an actor, I knew a little bit about it, but I knew it from the writing the script kind of side. So
how did you go from, okay, I found this thing, but now what?
It was like,
how
finding,
do you get into this
finding,
thing?
Finding, you know, it's like trying to get into the chocolate factory. You know, you need the golden ticket, and how do you do that? And so
my most recent guest, Luke Tabersky, said, well, I'm going to be an adventurer.
Right.
And what does that mean? Well, and he, you know, he is an adventurer, but, you know, how do you turn that into something? And it's interesting. So interested in your, you know, how you converted that sort of that feeling into a tangible career.
I guess I had to find out what careers were available to me. So that was the first thing. I was like, okay, well, what do I want to be? And I looked at all the different roles. You know, I bought books on do I want to be a director? No, I don't. It looks like I want to be a sort of a production manager, stage manager, because I want to be involved in making the thing. Now I know there's like 100 different jobs, but sometimes from the outside, you know, people think theatre is director, actor, stage manager.
Yes.
You know, now there's makeup artists, there's sound designers, there's lighting designers, there's, you know, costume designers, you have fight choreographers, you even have, you know, I've heard now in Hollywood there's a sex choreographer. I've never, definitely wouldn't want to be that, but, you know, there's all sorts of things.
I'm sure there's a whole army of, there's probably some, you know, 18-year-old listening to that and say, really?
Really? I want to do that.
Anyway.
But look, I had no experience, and I'm also at this point heading up for like late 20s, and I'm in debt because I've gone to university, and I'm not really. So it was kind of also a bit of survival. I want to do this, but I also don't want to be living at home with my mum, who's great, but you know.
Yeah.
So I wrote to all the theatre companies, and I applied for two different kinds of jobs, like stay at home, packing shelves, so that I could fund learning it, and also anything which would get me into a theatre. And you know, weirdly, the only job I ended up getting was as a backstage tour guide in the National Theatre, in the theatre that I kind of saw the show in.
Yes.
And what that did was the training for that was fantastic. I had no idea. I mean, I even applied to be a tour guide without having done one of their tours. Mm. It was like, I just want to get in there. Because once I get in there, I think I'll mm-hmm. be able to talk to people. But at the time, you had to train by meeting every single department.
Okay.
And so, like, within a week, I was sitting in front of the production manager that had worked on the show. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in front of people that were building things. So, as well as doing the tours for the public, I just spent my spare time badgering them.
Mm-hmm.
I then started working wherever I could, volunteering as a stage manager, production manager on some things. I did a lighting course at a local college, anything that would just get me mm-hmm. to understand the technical side of theatre.
Sure.
A couple of times I worked as a member of stage crew, where, you know, you at the time, now it's a different world, but you were judged on how much you could lift, you know, so as a woman, you had to kind of prove yourself. But it's different now, but because I've been climbing, I was actually in reasonable shape.
Fairly strong, yeah.
I couldn't do it now.
Lifting your own weight's not easy to do, is it?
And good finger strength as well. But again, it was like, okay, but I'm doing lots of bitty jobs and I'm a bit worried about what's going to happen. And then one day someone said, look, they're looking for a trainee health and safety person. And my first thought was, oh, that'll make me really unpopular. You know, safety for me, got it in the climbing sense, in the rafting sense, but I thought, I don't like how the Daily Mail
people,
is bonkers, conkers, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
That people are going to see me coming and think, she's going to stop us from doing something.
Yes.
But my second thought was, what if I was a different kind of person? Sometimes the way to change something is to get in there. And so maybe there's a world where I can be like I was at the climbing wall, you know, making sure people were safe, but actually helping them
climb.
Because look, I've seen what we do at the National Theatre, and we already have a safety show, so we're not stopping anything now. So how are we doing that?
Interesting.
And that was 2000. So 2002, I was a tour guide. 2004, I joined the safety team. So it was completely. Yeah. If I hadn't read the newspaper that day when I was not picking up my results, I would never have.
I'm going back. I've done a few of these podcasts now, there's some things that stand out, the sort of similarities with some of the things. My friend Robert Earl Stewart, he was struggling a little bit. He's a writer, and he had a job at a bakery, and he got into a big spat with his boss, and he just quit in a huff. And he was going to get married next month, and he was still living in his parents' home, and you know, and he went home. And he opened up the newspaper, and there was an advert for a reporter photographer. And he looked at that, and he said, "I'm going to get that job." And he got that job.
Yeah,
and so it's just uncanny how that story is so similar to yours.
Yeah, and I think as well, like they say, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and all that. And I think maybe sometimes as well, when you're,
there's a bit of that, and there's also a bit of. You know, sometimes people say the sort of kind of fortune sometimes favors you a little bit. I think some of that isn't external. Some of that may be going on in our subconscious, that we're sort of, you know, doing some things that our subconscious are sort of, is sort of helping us in a way that we don't really understand.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's.
So I bring in Master Chang here, but I know that you and
I
both familiar.
We can talk about Hapkido a little bit. But
I know that Master Chang will talk about the way we can sabotage ourselves.
Mm.
That actually, I think what you're right is that maybe your friend, you know, wasn't going down the path that he should have been. And there's something inside of you that, you know, that can sometimes do that. Like, you know, maybe, I mean, I don't think I was a natural outdoor pursuits or climbing wall instructor. I have friends who are so natural at that. I love them, but there's a particular lifestyle. And maybe inside my brain was saying, you need to do something different. And the physiotherapy was wrong. I don't know. But I kind of think that we do sometimes, we can self-sabotage ourselves. And sometimes we're not consciously thinking, I'm looking for something. And I think sabotage in a good way.
Yes,
I think
it's, exactly. You know, when we say sabotage, it meant course correct.
Course correct is probably a nicer way of putting it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's interesting. And allowing people to do that. And so if someone ever comes up to me with a radical change, I try to facilitate and understand it rather than go, are you crazy?
Yes.
You want to become a monk, or you want to, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And we're not in, you know, in the other person's shoes. You know, we don't understand what they want out of life. Maybe they don't understand what they want and where they've been. And so we shouldn't be too quick to judge.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's helpful to to sense to help someone sense check what they're yeah. thinking and doing. But absolutely. But yeah, I think the mind and the mind works in weird ways, and self-sabotage or course correct is there are moments in life where that sort of that does happen, and it's sometimes we do have to think about it. Comes back to that your point about gut and that gut feel, and it doesn't come from nowhere. It's informed by experience. So that's why I'm a firm believer in lots of different kinds of experiences to know what you do and don't want, and somehow that informs you, and somewhere in the recesses of your brain, your brain helps you along the right path. I don't know. It's a bit of a mystery, but
there's a kind of phenomenon. I mean, that in acting about them, someone who's miscast, and it's a real shame when someone says, "Oh, that person was really miscast," because of the sheer amount of work that goes into casting groups of people, making sure that they connect together, making sure. But sometimes you see someone who just embodies that role, and sometimes you see someone who is wearing it but isn't embodying it. And I think that's a little bit of the difference. And it's a real joy when you meet someone who really embodies something, whether it's on stage or off stage. So the whole thing is fascinating to me about how people find whatever their truth is. And I also don't think we have one. As I'm getting older, I'm beginning to realize you can be passionate about something and that'll lead you to something else. And so we don't have to find the one thing and forever.
I don't think we can. I don't think there's one thing that whether it's your career or I think there's a rare breed of person I read something Matt Damon when he was he went off to become an actor, and he felt sorry for all his friends who were going to university because they didn't know what they were going to do, and he always knew that that's what he wanted to be and do. So sometimes I think there's a small minority of people that that have that, but for a lot of us it's trying different different thing. We can be lots of different things, and sometimes, with lots of passions.
Sometimes you find that people have a compass rather than a map, which I think is really interesting, because some of these themes that they try have similar themes. So I think maybe in my life,
it's much better to have a compass than a map.
I agree.
The map is often wrong.
The
map is often wrong, right? I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this, and it might be modeled on someone else that had to, that you're not them, and also the systems that we work in are human created. We created them, so by people who are no smarter than we are. So. It doesn't mean that we have to get this degree to get that job to get that thing, and then we're fulfilled. And then we're always there are people sort of always waiting for that next thing to be happy or fulfilled or whatever. And that's waiting for Godot. That's waiting for the thing that's never going to arrive.
Exactly. That's a nice tangent.
It's very interesting. People's journeys are fascinating. So you then got into doing.
So I was a trainee then, and you know what? For a while, I didn't love it. I was doing it. I love working on the productions, but I was conscious that I was kind of an afterthought sometimes. Not me, but safety, and so I was part of a department. I had a fantastic mentor at the time. And he was the original safety manager, and he's fantastic about bringing new apprentices on, new trainees on.
So did he sort of did you seek him out as a kind of a mentor? Or did he?
He actually came with the job. He was my boss. There were people that I met, production managers, directors who I learned things from. I mean, the world is full of these teachers if we're looking for them. Yeah. But. There are different kinds of directors. So I worked with, when I say I worked with as well, sometimes you're in the room with them and sometimes you're advising them from afar. But I think her name's Phyllida Lloyd. I always get her and Phyllida Law mixed up, but Phyllida Lloyd is the great director, and she was phenomenal to watch work because she got safety and she got why it was important. It can be very, very delicate working with creative teams because they can see you and think you're going to stop something. So they they start from a place of mistrust,
mm-hmm.
and then that makes it really hard because right. you're trying to win them over and then right. say, you know, let's get to the truth of what you want to achieve mm. and we'll try and achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what, and most of the time good safety is just expensive. It's mm. not you can't do it, it's just that it might mean that we need to send someone on a course mm-hmm. or we need time.
Yes.
So anyway, some directors like Phyllida just get it and just start the conversation early.
Mm.
You know, and if you start it really, really early, it doesn't become an issue. It's like, mm. okay, we did the show recently, was amazing show, that was a musical by Tori Amos, which mm. had it's called The Light Princess, and mm-hmm. the lead singer, Rosalie Craig, had to sing whilst in a harness, being hoisted up bookcases, and sometimes when she wasn't roped in at all, being manhandled mm. up by acro balancers. It was phenomenal. But you know right from the beginning, she's going to need core muscles, so she's training. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's going to need lots and lots of time in a rehearsal room, up at height to get familiar. And safety doesn't really get talked about. It's accepted, mm. you know, right from the beginning when I do that. Whereas sometimes a director, it's very, very rare, but they won't bring you until the very end, and mm-hmm. you go, oh, now I've got a problem to solve, which is going to mm. be a lot harder.
Interesting.
So at the beginning, it was learning how to have these conversations mm-hmm. and learning, you know, who you can have them with.
Right.
And, you know, and my boss, Tony, he put me in lots of meetings, lots of, you know, he just let me kind of, he said, I'll always back you up in whatever you say mm-hmm. and just put me in front of lots of people. So it was good. And I did lots of amazing shows there. That mm-hmm. was when I worked with Juliette Binoche. And
right.
Then, but there became a moment where I thought, not loving it, and I'm not sure I'm going to go anywhere here. Mm-hmm. So I moved across to the South Bank Centre,
right?
Which was stupidly close. It was one of those. It wasn't really a choice. I didn't say I want to stay on the Thames, although mm-hmm. I have to say I absolutely adore working beside the river.
I love walking by that area. Yeah. There's just something about it that even if you're not going to see the shows, but you know, just got the BFI there and the booksellers and
yeah.
there's just something really magical about that part of London.
It kind of gives anyone a license to be creative mm. walking along there, I think. Mm. But so working beside the South Bank mm-hmm. was for me was also great. I get to stay by the river.
Yes.
and the South Bank Centre is a very different, so the National Theatre produces its own mm-hmm. own shows and the South Bank receives it, so mm. it's a very
okay.
different
okay.
lots of different energies
yeah.
and stuff
yeah.
but and I while I was there I met someone who wasn't my direct boss for a while but was a couple of above me, someone called Catherine Mallion, and she was quite a unique individual. She's actually now the executive director of the RSC.
Mm-hmm. But the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Royal Shakespeare mm-hmm. Company, yeah, of course. So she basically wanted people to think a bit more for themselves. Mm. And this is when life suddenly became more interesting for me. You know, she would send, there was a group of us that she looked after, and she would send us articles from the Harvard Business Review going, mm-hmm. have you thought about this?
Mm.
Or, I guess she just wanted us to think about our jobs a little differently.
A little more laterally.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was when I thought, this is interesting.
Yes.
They're not expecting me here just to be, you know, here's a solution, here's
yes.
an answer, here's a thing. It's
yes.
like, it's actually my job to start engaging these people.
Mm.
And so then I went to a conference, the IOSH, the Institute of Occupational Safety and Health mm-hmm. conference. Normally I'm not a fan of conferences, mm. but at this particular conference, I have to look up his name, actually I should have brought it with me. A chap stood up who was responsible for branding Pepsi and some of the other
okay.
Sugary drinks and other things, and mm. he was talking about the concept of branding, and he mm. said the big fault that safety and health and safety has is that you guys don't sell yourself.
Mm.
You think that it's enough to stand up and say,
yes,
here's the answer. You don't package it.
Mm.
You also, when someone attacks safety, like if there's a mm. bad article, you don't have a response that comes from one place. So if mm-hmm. someone wants to attack a big company and call it into disrepute, let's say, you know, McDonald's, for example,
yes.
McDonald's can respond because it has an identity
mm-hmm.
outside of its employers.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not attacking just one person.
Right.
And he said, that's your problem with safety. Mm. And it was like that and Catherine were two major light bulb moments for me.
Mm.
And I went, you know what? I'm doing this all wrong.
Mm.
Actually, I need to have these conversations in a different way.
Yes.
Make them much more human. Take the paperwork is necessary, but change. The paperwork should be the tool, not the master.
Yes.
Yes. And
that's when
I really began to realize that I could do things differently and life became a lot more interesting.
Mm.
And then at the same time that this kind of thinking started happening, the then technical director of the National Theatre, Mark Dakin, called me back and said, if I gave you a blank sheet of paper to redesign safety, would you come back?
And it Where do I sign?
Yeah, it really was that, you know, that moment of going, wow, what an opportunity. And then he became probably one of the most important people that I've ever worked with, because he just had that approach to everything. Mm-hmm. He was one of the world's best lateral thinkers. Mm-hmm. And so if I was to kind of talk about mentor, there are a few, but the one of the most significant ones is definitely... Sadly, no longer at the National. Mm. He's now moved to the Royal Opera House. Like I said, we all changed jobs.
All changed jobs, yeah.
But I was able to then bring that approach into the National Theatre.
Is there, just given your experience, Royal Shakespeare Company, National Theatre, is there a particular style or styles of shows that you quite enjoy working with or doing?
I don't know.
Is it more the people? The
people can really make it. I mean, there are some phenomenal people. So there's a lighting designer called Paulie Constable. Mm-hmm. She's an award-winning designer, but her passion is actually for the environment. And I mean, there's lots of things that she's interested in. But she's also part of a group of people that are trying to change the way that theatre's put on and do it more sustainably. But working on a show she's on, she's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Some designers that you work with that you just think this is going to be a lot of fun. Right. Actually, the shows that are tricky are the ones that are most interesting. We did this show recently. We should have been applying the chaos theory of physics or something to the show. Essentially, the set was an office, and then halfway through, they raised up the ceiling of the office, which was essentially a big grid, and they pulled all of the tables and chairs up to leave them hanging in strands. It was supposed to go from an office in the Shakespeare show As You Like It and then into the Forest of Arden. Fantastic concept. But if you drop a necklace onto a table and then pick it up, every time you pick that necklace up, it'll pick up in a slightly different way. You know that instinctively, but what we didn't realise is what that would do to our tables and chairs. And so they kept getting tangled, and sometimes they got tangled in a way that was safe, and sometimes they got tangled in a way that if you went up to them and touched them, they would fall. At the same time we were pulling up the tables and chairs, we were flying people. So of the shows we ran, I think we 50 of them we had to stop halfway through, bring the stuff down, untangle it, and bring it back up again. So that show wasn't easy, but it was a lot of fun to kind of figure out, okay, what can we do about this? And I'm not going to claim credit for any of this stuff. It's a team effort. But actually sitting in the room sometimes and seeing some of the brains trying to figure this stuff out is absolutely fascinating. Add into that, because we were flying people, I got to try out the flying in the theatre, and they flew me like a performer.
Oh, wow.
And that was incredible. It went right back to my climbing wall roots. Except that people flying is a totally different concept to climbing, of course, in that you're... And this is what you sometimes forget when you work in the industry, is as a performer, you have to do something in such a way that the audience gets something from it. It's not just about your own personal enjoyment,
yes.
Right? So when it's very painful being put in a flying harness, because they really squeeze you in. But the ropes that you hold, so I'm used to, like, you know, between 6 and 9 mil for climbing rope. This was 3 mil. So it's like holding tiny pieces of string in your hand. And it's really tough. It's like wire rope. So it's really...
Sorry, it's 3 millimeters.
3 millimeters, yeah. It's absolutely tiny in terms of thickness.
Wow. What is that stuff made
like
from?
It's like steel or something.
Right. And it doesn't feel like... So it must be weird, because it must feel like, oh, this thing's going to snap any moment.
That's exactly what it feels like. And now I've got to do a forward somersault. Great. So they start you off on the ground, and they put you in the... There are different types of flying harness depending on what you want. And they can set different they can set different levels to it. So somersaults can be either easy or hard. So they can give you a fairly easy ride or not. So you start off just off the ground, and you feel what it's like to move. And then you also then have to understand counterweights, because to move yourself forward and backwards, you balance your arms and your legs, and you have to have really strong core. And you also have to lean slightly forward, because when you're at height and you're flying down, if you just hang straight as you would maybe as a climber being lowered down, the audience won't see your reaction.
Sure.
So that classic Peter Pan pose where the one leg is straight and the other leg is bent comes partly from shows, but also partly because that weights you slightly to push you slightly forward. So actually it's easy to fly like that. So that's all fine on the ground. And then they take you up. Well, our theatre fly tower is like 30 metres high.
Interesting.
So they took me up 9 meters, and that was about as high as the climb wall was. And I was like, no, I'm okay. And then they took me up 15, and I could feel my palms sweating. And then that's when the mind kicks in. Okay, you know it's not going to break, but it feels like it's going
to
break.
Yeah, because you can see it. You can see all the way down, and you're not sat on anything that's seemingly holding you. Yeah. Wow, that's got to be a trip.
It's all in the mind. It really is, because you know it's safe, and you've seen the stats, right? You know your head is telling you everything is fine.
Well,
your heart
this is
safe.
Right. That's right. There are many things like that. I did a little piece on terrorism that around that. It's the same thing. That's why terrorism works. It's because, you know, there's this irrational part of our brains that respond and react. That's fascinating.
And I asked the team I was with, you know, what's it like to work with the performers? Mm-hmm. Because how do you act up here? And they said, okay, there are different sites. The guys I was working with flew, the performers in the Paralympics, they flew, the performers in Sochi. Mm. And one of them said, one of the directors he works with says, if she doesn't get someone to throw up on the first day, then she's not working them hard enough. So some of them have the mentality of, look, we'll just push you through.
Yeah.
But some of them, it is literally going over and over and over again. So you may have I mentioned Rosalie Craig, and I feel happy talking about her because she was a natural and she took to it and was really great. But there are some that you will only get them in the harness for 6 minutes, and then they're saying, take me out. Yeah. And so that is little and often. And look, okay, at the end of the day, if they're really never going to be happy, the quality of the show isn't going to be enough, so you don't do it. But most of them will get there.
Right.
And from the beginning to the end of the 2 hours I was up in the harness, I was definitely happier.
But
there were times, you know, it's all in the mind. It's a complete mind game. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, though. Interesting. Do you ever coach or work with the actors to try and overcome that that fear, or is that a big part of the work, or a part of the work?
It's not part of my work, but it is definitely something that the theatres do. We actually have a welfare officer who does that.
Okay.
Because, you know, some of them will be great, but just to get onto the stage, you know, in the old days, it was alcohol. Mm-hmm. You had a drink and then you went on the stage and performed. Not everybody,
right.
I have to say. And that was interesting. I know, you know, some of the friends of mine who do this job in television, you're dealing with shows where there might be stunts on television and the big names will turn up and they'll have a drink beforehand. And it's how do we embrace the frailties of people to enable them to do the show? And at what point do you say, okay, that's enough? Because the other thing is, there are elements of ego in the job.
Sure.
So the best actors I've worked with have none. No ego at all.
Interesting.
They're just lovely, lovely people who are just phenomenally talented. But there are some who will tell you what they're entitled to. And if you say, you know, you can't do that because it's against the theatre rules or something, you know, let's think of something. Or, you know, I'm going to smoke. You know, it's illegal in Britain to smoke inside, but you're going to tell me I can't do it because I'm so and so. And then it's how do you cope with that? And it's trying to have the right conversations with the right people. But to be honest, they're the draw. And when you see them out on the stage, they are phenomenal. And you think, oh well, you know, maybe that's the price we pay. But it's been a long, long time though. We were talking about this today actually. The culture changes. There is a culture change about what isn't acceptable, and we just don't really see that behaviour anymore. But we were all laughing because in the old days the pictures of rehearsal rooms all had people smoking with pipes and everything, and that wasn't the actors practicing. So,
very interesting.
Yeah.
I did want to talk about Hapkido for a little while.
I dropped that reference.
Yeah, you dropped that reference, and Anna and I practice Hapkido, which is a Korean martial art. I just wanted to just talk a little bit about what you get out of practicing a martial art like that, and do you get any benefit in your professional life and or outside at all? I'm not. I don't know about you, but I'm not fending off muggers on my way to work every day or you know any day. So, you know, why do it? And I'm not training to become the next UFC champion either. So, I'd be curious to get, you know, your experiences and views on it.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have the National Theatre to thank for Hapkido. So our Sabu Nim's partner worked at the National.
Right.
And when I came out of Wales, I was lost for lots of reasons, but also because I wasn't being as physical as I had been. Mm. I was really, you know, what do I do in London? I can't climb. Mm-hmm. You know, climbing's super expensive and the walls aren't that great. And I was just having a conversation one day and Joe said, well, would you like to try martial art?
Mm.
And I said, you know what? I'd love to do that. Mm. I've always wanted to do that. My parents were quite, you know, they didn't really want me to do it when I was growing up. So the point is, I found my way into Hapkido just because I was looking for something else. Mm-hmm. And I tried one lesson and loved
it. Mm-hmm.
And I never thought I would stick with it. If you had said to me, I never really stuck with anything. You know, I was happily moving around from thing to thing apart from theatre. But I found myself going to one or two lessons, one a lesson a week, two lessons a week, and then starting key class.
Mm-hmm.
And the time when you're in something, I guess you don't realize what it's given you, but when you look back you think, wow, I'm significantly different. So I do have a stressful job, and Hapkido gives me the tools to cope with that stress. And it's interesting, actually, we look at Hollywood to our examples of why people do martial arts. You know, gosh, wouldn't I love to be as brilliant as Jason Bourne and be able to pull off those moves and all that sort of thing, and hope that if the mugger happened, I would cope like that. But of course I wouldn't. That's not what it's for. But there are other fights we have. There's the daily commute.
Sure.
There are the challenges that life throws at us, and Hapkido has given me the ability to fight those off. One way is to not fight. One of the best stories that I love that Master Chang talks about is the man who draws a line in the sand on the beach. And he says to his students, you know, how do you make that line shorter? You know, and some people rub out a bit of it and some people cut it in half.
Yeah.
And then the master draws a longer line next to it.
Right.
And that really resonated with me. And I think it's about, you know, instead of trying to defeat the other person, it's to kind of accept what's going on and make your own line longer. Mm. So that's what I try to bring in my role. And I still get people who don't want to talk about safety. They don't want the conversations. They don't possibly see what I'm trying to do. And if I get angry with them or get involved in that conversation, it's not going anywhere. So it's like, bring it back to yourself, you know, and draw your own line.
Yeah.
But also because on the dojang, I face risk. In the dojang, on the mat, you face risk. You're your own opponent. It's not risk. I mean, you and I've sparred and, you know, you're fantastic, but thinking, oh, I'm going to get a black eye if I don't defend myself. Yeah. It's actually, am I going to defeat myself?
Step out of the way, or or are you going to think about what to make for dinner whilst you're sparring, or what are that problem at work or whatever? I suppose if you did that, that may not end very well.
Yeah. I mean, your guest, Martian, he spoke about being on the bike and not being able to think about anything.
Yes.
And, you know, when I'm doing Hapkido, I can't think about anything. I mean, sometimes it'll creep in, but that's what it also gives me, wonderful release of, here I am doing a thing I love and I don't have to think about anything
else. There's so many ways of achieving that state, but we're so often not in that state.
Yeah.
And we should be, you know, much more. I very much agree. It does that very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm running or riding my bike, it does that as well. But sometimes I find it takes a while to get into that zone.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a wonderful way of one of the things that I've taken away is that sort of mind body connection.
Yes.
That you know, I was always very sort of intellectual, and you can kind of separate those two, and I could just, you know, succeed by just being smart and you know. And it doesn't work like that. And you know, you have to, you know, the mind and the body work together. And when you're one of the things I've taken away is when I'm sitting around a room, whatever the context is, I can see people's emotional reactions much better, I think, than just, you know, we're talking about this proposal and does it make sense, and do the benefits exceed the costs and blah blah blah, and that's how we're going to make the decision. And there's so much more going on beyond that. There's, you know, there's politics, and there's this guy's afraid of the, you know, and you can, there's a lot of emotion, and you can kind of feel that you know, almost physically.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that sort of just making sure that I'm not separating those two things, and the work that I do is a huge benefit. It's just a constant reminder of that, that, you know, and it's not just the body either. It's not, you can't just like physically overpower whatever obstacle, you know, you get. There's a harmony there. And, you know, that, you know, there are many ways to get that, but it's so important to remain not only physically active, but just connected mentally with that, you know, that physical activity.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of gives you, well, I think we are learning to see what's really there. Mm-hmm. I, there's some, you know, great quotes that I know Sabinum's talked about, you know, seeing our true nature and not being afraid and all that sort of thing. But I think you're right, being in a room, particularly tense meetings, and realizing what's the subtext, what's not being talked about, how are people talking about it? You know, the idea that, particularly in the key meditation, that the, you know, the wonderful other image that they give us of the glass jar that's full of muddy water, and if you let it settle, the mud sinks to the bottom and you can see through. And actually, sometimes that's really important for the job that I do, is see the problem that's really there. So, you know, you solve the one problem that everyone thinks is the issue, and then you actually think, that's not what's going on here, or, you know, which is another, you know, going right back to the beginning, we talked about putting the harness on, where you've solved the harness problem because they're not going to fall from height, but now they can't act, you know. Or you hear about the first aiders who will assess someone's broken leg and they'll tie the legs together, but the lady's pregnant and that's no good. so I think it gives you it gives you a bit of a sense, maybe it helps with the gut and all that sort of thing, gives me tools for breathing, you know. Massive amounts of acting is about correct breathing.
Right.
We have a voice coach who teaches breathing. Actually, our voice coach did do some key lessons at one point just to experience what that was like. And for me, I have to deliver presentations. I'm talking in front of people.
I don't know, 90, that's so much of it is physical.
Yes.
Well, it's physical and it is mental. You need to know your subject.
Yeah, of course.
Right? And you need to know how to deliver it. And you physically, you become more confident when you know your topic.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's, you can't just stand there and just be monotone about it. It doesn't, you know, there's so many ways to connect to people that technically, people that are sort of technically very astute sometimes don't get right.
Yeah.
Or people that are very, you know, intellectually very brilliant that don't get that right.
Yeah.
And we work with people, and people have got their own quirks and ticks, and we've got to be able to understand, regardless of what industry it is. I mean, you're working with people, you know, physically, they're doing some challenging things, but I think it's, you know, these are things that apply to all kinds of contexts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that connection is so important. And the other thing that I try and work on is how we build that connection up. And it can start right from when someone walks into a building. So the other thing that interests me is the environment that you're in. How do we connect to the environment? What is the environment giving to us? You know, if you're in a positive office with good energy and people can talk, but if you don't do well in open plan offices and you're really struggling, so it's about understanding those contexts of people.
When that people makes such a hit. I've worked in open plan offices where people hot desk, and sometimes you don't know the person who sat next to you, or anyone in the room. And my God, you sit there, and I've been sat here for, you know, whatever, 6 hours, and no one said a word to me or whatever. And that's very soul destroying, actually.
Absolutely. And that stuff fascinates me, because that's what gets in the way of doing the jobs I do and doing the jobs we all do. And sometimes it's so obvious as to say to the person next to you, hello, I'm, you know, or saying to a new person, do you want to go for lunch or something? It's so funny. We look at these really big, expensive things that, you know, companies will say, we'll give you a safety system that will solve all your problems, or here's an app or something, like, actually,
a piece of software or whatever.
It's a small human interaction or something that will go a lot further. And I guess that comes back to what, in a way, the Pepsi guy was saying about what our identity is. And I try and give safety an identity that is a positive identity. So if you close your eyes and you visualize safety symbols, you'll always see warning signs, danger signs.
Yes.
Why not something helpful? So why not something that reaches across and helps someone out? And you know, there's that element to it. And actually, I suppose if you bring this back to Hapkido, that element is present in Hapkido. We are working on joint locks. You and I know how painful they can be, but that you do it with a level of humanity. So it's not, we're not forcing someone to do something. We're helping each other. We'll do these techniques on each other. Mm-hmm. And weirdly, that it, through that pain, we develop a level of trust. Yeah. You know, so that stuff's much more interesting. Mm. And so what I'm also learning is, you know, make those connections, find out the weird small things that we always do. You know, how do we take that step back and find out, well, that's the way we've always done it, but why is it that way? And is there any way we could do something different? And, you know, I'm fascinated by the people that can just see the world in a different way.
Interesting.
I'm very fascinated by magicians. I've worked with some of them, and I just love the way they think. And, you know, they hire magicians into casinos to try and work out who's beating the system.
Because
magicians just look at the world differently. I'm not a magician, but I'm absolutely fascinated by them.
Interesting. And we've been going for an hour and about, just under 20 minutes now. Might be good to wrap up soon. But you're also, you've got your site. You're also working on a podcast of your own.
Yes, I
gather. I don't want you to give too much away, but be, you know, if anything that you, any thoughts that you had around it would be interesting.
I was obviously inspired by your podcast, but I have access to people who, I'm very interested in creativity.
Yes.
What sparks creativity? Mm-hmm. Where does inspiration come from? Mm-hmm. It's something that for a long time I didn't think I had any right to. Creativity is something that creative people do, and I have not been branded by society.
So many people, many people think like that.
Yeah. So where does that come from? Why did I think like that? Because we're all creative, and when you embrace that side of yourself, you know, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I have access to people who both are determined by society as creative and also people that service creativity. So I just wanted to explore that through conversation. And I've had a few people say they're not afraid to step up and have a go. So that's what I'm hoping to put together. I've got this kind of idea of calling it creatively speaking. So that's what we'll go with for now.
Cool. We'll be on the lookout for that. I think we covered a lot. Was there anything that we may have missed? I think we had a good discussion, just wondering if there's anything else that we may have. I would, first of all, I'd also love to have you back. Before we wrap up, where can people find you on social media, on the internet?
I'm taking first steps on Twitter. So the tweets are beginning to come thick and fast, but it's at Anna J. Glover.
Okay.
You can find me, I have a website, Anna Glover Consulting. That's also an Instagram account. So.
Okay, great.
And I love quirky images of safety done well, you know, pictures of things where it's, you know, I try to post things where they've been good in films, things like that. So all that stuff I put up there.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, people can check you out there. This was awesome. I love this. It was a great conversation. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
We'll keep our eyes peeled for, you know, for your podcast. And,
I have to do it now.
It's out there now in the world. But this was great. Thank you so much, and you know, best of luck. And you know, we'll see each other quite regularly. But you know, thanks again, and all the best for all the ventures.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks, Anna.
Well, I loved that. That was an amazing conversation and a wonderful episode. And if this episode is anything to go by, I think that Anna's podcast is going to absolutely kill it. I love that part about letting your path find you. And it's a little bit like when you're lost, I guess, in the pre-GPS sense of the word. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but if you've been lost somewhere and you kind of frantically set off in whatever direction, you don't really, if you're anything like me, you don't really get very far. You certainly don't get to where you're going. But I do find if you relax, take some breaths, gather your thoughts, you're more likely to figure it out. I liken that part of the conversation to be a little bit about how to find your way when you're a little bit lost. Do check out the show notes. There's some great stuff in there. And once again, if you like this episode, please share it. Please subscribe on iTunes and leave a rating or a review. It really helps us out. If you have any feedback, you can send it to allthingsrisk@gmail.com. Check out allthingsrisk.com, which is my website. We've got some more great episodes on the way, so stay tuned. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.